Hey. Okay, Mom. Well, at this time, I would like to introduce our speaker of this evening, Miss Karen from Prescott, Arizona. Yay. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Karen.
My sobriety date is August 24th, 1992. My sponsor is Kim, so if you have any issues with what I say tonight, please take it out with her. She's in charge of me. Oh, I need to even speak closer? Like, kiss the microphone, John? Okay. So it's great to be here tonight. I lived in San Diego for 24 years. I retired from the Navy and have been gone for about 6 years back to my hometown because my dad died and I'm watching over my mom. So nice to be back. So born and raised in Prescott, Arizona. Small hometown, northern Arizona, very conservative. A great place to grow up for many people. A tough place to grow up for me. I was a little girl that struggled with my gender quite a bit. I had an older brother and a younger brother. My younger brother's 5 years younger, so, but my older brother was a year and a half older, and I hung out with him and his friends. And I just wanted to do what they did. And I wanted to, ride the BMX and skateboard and shoot each other with BB guns and not wear a shirt and do all the things that the dudes got to do. And I didn't understand when I went to my mom and said, why do I have to start wearing a shirt? And she said, because little girls wear shirts. I didn't understand because I was hanging out with all the guys. And it was like that. My childhood was just like that. I think from the moment I was kicked out of the womb, I was fighting for gender equality. And I think I've spent my whole life fighting for gender equality. Which at 60, I'm okay with. It's something that I've come to terms with. But my father was an alcoholic, and I didn't obviously know that when I was young, but when I was 5 years old, he used to give me glasses of booze out of his Coors, can. And so I was like daddy's little drinking buddy. And I didn't like the taste of beer when he first gave it to me, but I liked being daddy's little girl and being cool. And I knew that it made me somehow special. And that dad, a year later, when I was 6 years old, I was playing downstairs with my brothers, and my older brother and I were getting flipped off of my dad's back. And, we called it horsey, playing horsey. And so, it'd get flipped off. My dad's on all fours. He'd flip us off his back, giggle, get up, run around, get back on dad's back, flip us off again. And we were playing that over and over. And then I got flipped off, and I came up, and my left arm was like a noodle. And I stood up, and I said, I think I broke my arm. And I had snapped both bones in my forearm. And that's the last time my dad ever played with any of us. So from that point on, my dad went into isolated drinking. On the outside, we looked like a very functional family. My parents owned a clothing store. Very well known in town. Still, if you've lived in Prescott for a long time, you remember my family. But my dad never went camping, never did anything with us again. And my older brother blamed me. My younger brother was too small to really understand. But my older brother hated me. And so, he started to kind of torment me and kick my ass. And what happened for me was that as a child, I remember joy one time, and it was playing horsey. And that joy then got paired with pain. And so, and that's been kind of a theme throughout my life. Like joy, I kind of get afraid like, oh shit, other shoe's gonna drop, right? Because it started really young for me. And so I kept trying to fight for equality in my body. And when I was 9 years old, I tried out for Little League. And there wasn't a girl in my hometown that had tried out for Little League before. And so I don't know why they let me try out, but that night the commissioner called and he said, you know, Mrs. Salt, your son made it, but your daughter, she can't play. And my mom said, oh, well, why not? And he said, well, little girls don't play Little League. And she said, well, then why did you let her try out, right? And so I remember like going and just kind of like going off to my bedroom and licking my wounds. And then later that night, one of the first badass women in my life called, and her name was Faith Blair. And I don't know how many of you remember Matt Holliday, the baseball player, right? His grandmother was called and said, I'm going to coach a Little League team. But I told him I wouldn't coach unless your daughter's on my team. And so I played Little League. I was the first girl in Prescott to play Little League. And I was heckled by parents. They hated me. The commissioner wanted me off the team. I mean, it was a fight for gender equality, right? Like, I'm out there just trying to be myself. And as myself was not, it just wasn't okay. And so I didn't try out again next year. But what I did do is I started to drink. And so at 9 years old, I had my first drunk, like real drunk. And a friend of mine had moved away from town, and she came back, and she was a little older than me, and all the boys liked her. And so we went down the road to some of her friend's house, and I had had beer before, but they were drinking hard liquor. And I drank hard liquor like I was drinking beer. And then I walked into a tree, and then I was throwing up, and then I was stumbling, and then she left me at the front door because she was afraid of my parents. And I crawled up the stairs and passed out in the bathroom. And then I remember crawling down the hallway to my room when my parents knocked on the door later, where I threw up in my room all night. And I was 9 years old, and my parents, all they asked me was, what did you take? And I probably could have died that night. Like, I was really, really sick. And the next morning, I went into the kitchen, and my mom didn't say a word to me. She just was like, And I was like, And that was it, right? Like, there was never, like, any real repercussions in my family I just was able to be myself. But that incident kind of kicked off a real rebellion stage in me, because I figured if I couldn't be myself, I was going to check out. And so I started to steal booze. I would go to, like, the local Super X, which is, like, the CVS, and I would shoplift. I had this really big puffy red jacket, and I would just put a bunch of stuff in it and just walk out with it. And then, like, all kinds of stuff, like stuff I didn't need. Like, I was just such a little thief. But I always had booze, and then I would take the booze and I would hide it in the woods. And then later on that night, I would leave my house and go and get drunk. And me and my friend, we'd go down to, like, the skating rink, and we'd get in trouble. And then we'd get really drunk, and then we'd sneak back into our houses. And this was in sixth grade, I was doing this. And in seventh grade, I showed up to school to hang out with my best friend after summer vacation. And she wouldn't talk to me. And as a child, I had no idea what was happening. As an adult, I figured her mom said, if you hang out with her one more goddamn day, I'm gonna kick your ass. She would have nothing to do with me. But, you know, we got in a lot of trouble together. We stole her dad's motorcycle. We wrecked it. She had a concussion. Like, I was that kid. I was that kid that was really, really acting out. And so, you know, once I got into, like, junior high school, I was just ditching. I was ditching a lot, and I was getting away with it. You know, it was back in the day when there weren't cell phones, there weren't anything. So I'd ditch a day, and then I'd go home the next day, and I'd ditch to go home and get the letter out of the mail that said I wasn't at school the day before, and I'd sign the letter and get it back in. And I did that all through high school. I just partied. And so by the time I got to graduation from high school, I had to beg a teacher for a D so that I wouldn't have to take my senior class over again. And I don't think he gave me a D because he thought I earned it. I think he gave me a D because he really wanted me the hell out of his life. And that's just the person I was. Bottom 10% class of, bottom 10% of my high school graduating class, and had nothing going for me other than a really great friend and a really great partier. And if I needed booze, my parents would buy it. So You know, it was just kind of the Wild West, Arizona, okay? And, but right before the end of high school, the Navy recruiter came, and we're sitting in class one day, and there's this Navy recruiter up there, and I'm like, oh, hell no, right? And so the teacher's like, there's like half a dozen of you that need to stick around and speak to this guy. And she names my name. And I'm like, oh, God, no. All my friends take off. They're off to go party. I just can't wait to get outside and start partying with them. And I sit down with him, and he starts asking me a bunch of dumb questions. And one of the questions he asked me is, have you done drugs in the last 6 months? And I said, yes. And he was shocked, because I guess everybody lies, but I didn't want to go in the Navy, so I didn't care. And he said, don't do drugs for 6 months, and I'm going to contact you again. I was like, whatever. And so 6 months later, I'm working at a gas station where I have no idea what even a dipstick is. It's a full-service gas station, and the Navy recruiter calls and says, hey, have you done drugs in the last 6 months? And I say, no, which I don't know why I said no that time. But he said, let's go down to Phoenix and talk to some people. And so that Thursday, I went down to Phoenix to talk to some people with him, and where he took me was to MEPS. And for those of you who don't know, MEPS is where they take you to enlist. And so, yeah, that's not funny. Yeah. Yeah. And so I did talk to some people. I talked to one person and asked me a bunch of questions, and then I went to another desk and I talked to someone, and then I did. And then at the end of the day, I'm standing on this stage and this dude's like, raise your right hand, and all these people are raising their right hands, and I'm like, so I raised my right hand because I'm just a drunk, right? I have no idea what I'm doing with my life. And I enlisted in the Navy. It was 1983. And in 4 months, I left. February of 1984, I got on an airplane that I don't remember because I was drunk, and showed up in Orlando, Florida in boot camp. And that was the first time that I detoxed, was boot camp. 6 weeks of like trying to be off of booze and make it. And it was really, really hard for me. My recklessness went away. I was scared to death. Like, I was just really trying not to be seen for the first time in my life. And had no idea what I was doing. I was in the South. I was from Arizona. I just was like, what the hell has happened to me? And so at the end of boot camp, I went to this school called AT School, because I was dumb and didn't show up. I didn't sign for a rate. And so I was undesignated, which meant I was going to show up at a ship and work on deck and chip paint and brush off rust and repaint the ship. Like, this was the stuff I signed up for. And so they have this thing called a dream sheet. And on the dream sheet, they asked, where do you want to be stationed? And I said, anywhere West Coast. And so a couple days later, my orders came in, and I went to the USS Frank Cable in Charleston, South Carolina. And you know, I was 18 years old, and I was scared, and I was young, and I was naive, and I was very green. And so, you know, I show up on my first ship, and it's 1984, and women have just started to be on Navy ships. And so this is a ship with about 1,200 people. It's huge. It's a submarine tender, and there's about 60 women on board. And I did not do well. I show up, I end up in deck, chipping paint, brushing off rust, and repainting the ship. Haze gray and underway, which is the color. Haze gray is the color of every ship. And I struggled. And there was a lot of sexual harassment. There was a lot of, the men were not used to women being on board ships back in those days. It took a while. I would say like tail hook in the early 90s was really, early 90s was about when that started to really shift. But before my first year was up on the ship, I'd been sexually assaulted. I had been sexually targeted by my chief in my division, and I struggled. I would walk to the pier, and I'd call my parents and just talk about what a huge mistake I made. And I was drunk, right? And I did not have agency. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I didn't know how to advocate for myself. And I didn't have any friends. And then I met a friend. I went mess cranking on ships. Mess cranking is like working in the food service division. And I mess cranked and met this friend, and she was gay. And this one weekend, Tammy asked me if I wanted to come hang out with her and her partner at their apartment. And I did. And when I went and hung out with them and then met their friends, I realized that I'm gay. That one of the reasons that I had struggled so much, right, gender identity, was really that I grew up in a hometown that I didn't know that even gay was being an option, right? Like, I didn't know one person that was gay. There was no visibility. Ellen DeGeneres wasn't alive yet. That's not true. Rigorous honesty. Okay. I mean, there was no gay visibility. And so anybody in my hometown that was gay was closeted and hidden. And so I met Tammy and started hanging out with her and her girlfriend and went over there every weekend. And then I started to live at the apartment with them, and we would hitchhike every day from the ship. And, you know, we'd hang out and get drunk all weekend. And then we'd go back to the ship. And then at lunchtime, we'd leave the ship and catch a ride out to her house and get drunk and then go back to the ship and get in trouble for being drunk in the afternoon. But nobody, like, after I had the sexual assault, I was just such a rebel that nobody knew what to do with me. I was so angry. They're just like, leave her alone. So I just was able to kind of make it. And then I showed up at quarters one morning, and the chief said, the first lieutenant is looking for somebody to come be his yeoman down in his office. And being a yeoman is like doing administration. And so I had already learned what volunteering got me into, so I was like looking the other way and just no way. And that afternoon, he called me into his office and he said, you've been selected. And so, you know, that was kind of like an intervention. That was really a divine intervention for me, because I was able to start doing a profession in the Navy that I loved, right? And so I started to do administration, and it came second nature to me. I've always been a good writer. And I was out of deck department and a lot of the harassment that I had been experiencing. And so I became a yeoman, and then I went to this A school, this yeoman A school, and I came back, and then I worked in the admin office, and 3 out of 5 of us were gay. And I started to just really meet, like, all of the lesbians on the ship, and there was a lot of us. And so, you know, during the day we changed pronouns, and we, you know, were very closeted, because this, in 1984 to 1994 was before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And so we had what was called witch hunts, and NCIS would try to catch us. And so they would try to get someone to befriend you, and then that person would be straight, and then that person would turn you in. And so you never knew who was, like, really your friend and who wasn't your friend. If you went to a gay bar, there might be somebody from your ship at the gay bar. And so you didn't know if that person was a plant or if that person was actually at the gay bar. So we stopped going to gay bars. We really had to protect ourselves, because if they caught you, then they would interrogate you, and then they would try to get you to turn on a bunch of people, and that happened a lot. And so they would tell you they'd go easier on you. So if one of us got caught, we were all worried that, you know, there was going to be like a whole bunch of us that would be kicked out. And sometimes that happened. And so so I learned how to go deeper into hiding, right? Like, I was already hiding in my addiction. I was hiding with my identity, and then I had to go deeper and deeper into hiding to stay safe and to also protect those who I served with. And then I fell in love. I found my first girlfriend. You know, she was getting over somebody, so she probably wasn't available, but that's my life story, if you know what I mean. And so I fell in love with this chick who was on another ship, and a couple piers down, and then her ship got sent from Charleston down to Kings Bay, Georgia. And so I am very, very crafty and manipulative, because I'm an alcoholic, and I can figure a way out of any jam. And so I figured out how to swap from my ship to her ship so I could go down to Georgia and be with the love of my life, and I was 20 years old, right? So I leave my gay friends, and I leave my gay office, and I leave my people. I leave Tammy, and I leave everybody, and I transfer down to Georgia. and move into a trailer. It was amazing. Down a dark, dusty road. Oh, God. And, you know, start living with my first girlfriend. And, you know, we're drinking a lot and we're partying a lot and we're living the dream. And I hated my second ship initially. And then they figured out that I could go work for the chief engineer, and then I was fine. And, you know, I was down there with her and for about a year and a half when she decided that she was going to go back to her real love of her life, who she's not with anymore, by the way. And so we broke up. And then I was devastated, you know, like just absolutely devastated. So what do? I get drunker and drunker and drunker and angrier, and I just get more reckless and more rebellious. You know, I move in with other people, and I'm really just trying to figure out, like, what I'm doing with my life, right? And then I've been in now for about 3 years, and this master chief who I work for says, you know, I think you should reenlist. Like, I'm really good at my job, but I don't like the rules, like the hiding, the being hunted, all of the things that came with being in the Navy. But I couldn't imagine going back to Prescott, Arizona, because nobody's gay there, right? There's three of us now. So I can't imagine going back there, so I don't know what I'm going to do with my life, right? I don't have anything going for me. And so he says, you know, when we're down in the Bahamas, there's going to be a reenlistment ceremony on a stage at a casino. And so if you reenlist, you can reenlist on a casino. And I'm like, well, hell yes. Like, so I reenlisted on a casino, and I got orders to the Caribbean. So I get sent down to the Caribbean for 2 years. And I remember very little of it, other than I had a white Pinto that had a really bad muffler, and I had a girlfriend who I really did wrong, and if I ever see her again, she's the amends I still owe. And I was down there for 2 years partying, and it was a lot of fun. Antigua is where I was at. So after Antigua, I called my detailer, and I said, do you have anything on the West Coast? And the detailer said, actually, I don't, but I have Hawaii. And I was like, well, hell yeah, I'll go to Hawaii. So I go to Hawaii. I'm now in E5. I have 6 years in. It's 1989. I still don't know what I'm doing with my life. Still drunk every chance I can get, but great at my job. And I transfer to Hawaii. And Hawaii changed my life. So I started working at a place called Sing Pak Fleet. It's where the 4-star admiral staff is at. And I loved it. You know, it was a place, I worked for the fleet operations officer, and it was just a place where, like, the big shit happened. It was really cool. It was in a building with no windows, so it was really secretive. And so I started to really love the Navy, but I was still drinking a lot. And I didn't know, and I was also really angry. And so I didn't know how to stop drinking, but I had to be at work at 4:30 in the morning, so I did stop drinking at, like, I'd get off at, like, noon, and so I'd drink from, like, noon to, like, 8, and then I'd sleep. So I was starting to be a little bit more responsible, right? Because if I was late for work, I had this captain that would throw shit at you if you were late, and I was afraid of him. So I'm working for him, and then one day I'm in one of the other offices, and the love of my life walks in. And the moment I saw her, I knew, like there was just something about her. And her name was Sue, and I was head over heels when I met her. And so she and I had a 19-year relationship together. But I met Sue and started partying with Sue. She didn't drink like I did. She was going to school at night. Like, she was, like, responsible. It was so weird. But, you know, I started going to school, and then, like, when they'd give us a break, I'd sit in the car with a cooler and get drunk, and then she would come out when school was over. And I would just, you know, I was trying to figure out how to be a responsible adult and still very drunk. And so about 2 years after, you know, after she and I got together, she got orders to a little island out in the middle of the Indian Ocean called Diego Garcia. And she was told by the detailer, you know, we were considered single. So we were hoping to stay in Hawaii together. And that was something that we had to manage because straight people would get spouse co-location. They would transfer together, stay together, husbands and wives. But we were always considered single, so we really had to work and navigate our careers. And a lot of times we were separated. And so she got sent away for a year with a promise that she would come back, that she would get the orders of her choice after a year was up. And so I took orders to a squadron called VP1 out at Barbers Point, Hawaii, hoping that she would come back. And so she leaves, and every person that I partied with also transfers, like everyone. Like there was like a half dozen of us that were like really tight. They all transferred or they got out like all at the same time. And that was like a second, like I think like divine intervention, because now I'm by myself. Sue's gone, all of my friends are gone, and I'm hitting bottom. Like I'm a mess. And so August 23rd, 1992, I'm sitting in my living room on a lawn chair, because I don't want to drive to the beach by myself. So I have a lawn chair, I have a cooler next to me, I have a towel out, and I have a TV in front of me with a busted pitcher tube. So it's black and green screen, and I'm drinking beers watching that thing. My cat was there, his name was Six Pack, by the way. So I'm sitting there, and I know that, like, this is it. Like, I'm either gonna stop drinking or I'm gonna die. Like, I knew it. And I couldn't, every time I got drunk, I would try to fight people, and I knew that something was gonna happen. I also drove every time I drank. And so I knew that things were not good. And so I sat there and I drank all the beers, and then I went to sleep on the couch, and Six Pack was behind me. And I woke up the next day and I asked God, please don't let me drink today. And I had been asking that every day for about 3 months after they left. I didn't wanna drink. And then every day I'd drive home and I'd stop at the package store and I'd get six pack of beer, and I'd go home and drink it and pass out on the couch. But August 24th, 1992, I didn't drink. I came home, and I fed six pack, and I passed out on the couch. And I woke up the next morning, and it was my 27th birthday. So my AA birthday and my natal birthday are one day apart, which really, really fucks with people. So just saying. So I woke up the next day, it was my birthday, and I was alone and sober. And I tried to find a meeting, but there wasn't GPS back then. And so I drove and I cried and I couldn't find a meeting, so I came home and I passed out on the couch. And then the next day, there was a meeting over by the airport, kind of Pearl Harbor area, and I found this women's meeting, and I walked into that meeting, and the secretary of that meeting, her name was Linda. And Linda became my first sponsor. And so I don't know how people say, I'm Karen and I have 5 days of sobriety. I couldn't speak for 22 days without sobbing. I couldn't say my name. I just sat there and cried. And I think on my 22nd day, I remember saying that I had 22 days. It took me a while. But Linda became like my first sobriety hero. And she lived about a block from me. And so I would walk to her house and I'd hang out with her, and she was insane. And she had 5 years, which seemed like a million years to me at the time. It was just crazy. But she started me working on the steps. And what she told me that I'll never forget is she said, you just have so much willingness. And I think that's true. I think that my willingness has kept me going throughout my life. You know, the willingness to take suggestions, the willingness to do the next right thing, the willingness to make an amends, just the willingness to just keep trying, right? Because being human is difficult. And so so I'm sober, and I transfer to VP1. I have about 3 months of sobriety at that point. And I met my mentor, who was the command master chief. And I was a first class at that point. I had made first class right after I got sober. I made E6, and I had tried five times to make E5, five times to make E6. I get sober, and then like I make it, and it's like, whatever. So I show up at VP1, and I'm now the leading petty officer of the admin, and I'm stoked, right? Like my new addiction is my job, right? I'm like Joe Navy, just ready to do this thing and loving it. And I meet my command master chief, and he becomes my mentor, and I learn how to be a good chief there, and or a good LPO or a good sailor. I learn how to take care of my sailors. I learn how to stay sober. A year into about 9 months into my first year of sobriety, my squadron deploys to Diego Garcia. So I spend about, I don't know, a week with Sue before then she transfers to Guam because the detailer lied and she did not get the orders of her choice. Now she's gone and we're gonna spend 3.5 years apart. And so, you know, I'm devastated, but I get to see, you know, my love when I'm out in the middle of the Indian Ocean for like a week or two, which is just wild, you know, and really like the kind of hidden love that we had, like 2 weeks felt like such a gift because we just, you know, we were very limited on how much time we had together. So I go to Diego Garcia and I really get my shit together and I start working out and I stay sober. I have my first year of sobriety out there. And I get my wings and I am just really trying to get my career together because I want to make chief, right? Chief Petty Officer in the Navy is like every enlisted sailor's goal. And so I leave, or I, at the end of that deployment though, and deployments are six months, I have this experience. And Sue, my partner, her cousin has come to Hawaii to watch Six Pack while I'm gone, okay? So he's cat sitting and house sitting. I'm in Diego Garcia, she's in Guam, and I call home because we're about to come back to Hawaii, and I call home and I wanna talk to Pat and tell him that I'm ready, you know, that I'm coming back. And he's an asshole to me on the phone. He's like, yeah, the landlord found out about the cat and said the cat has to go, and I'm like, and he's just, and then he hangs up on me. So I'm like sitting on my desk and I'm like, what the hell has just happened? And then my command master chief walks in and he says, I need to see you in my office. So I go into his office and he says, shut the door, which you, males and females, you don't have a door shut. Like it's just, you don't do it. But so I'm like, okay. So I shut the door and he said, a chief called my wife and told her that you and I are having an affair. And so, so I'm stunned. And I'm like, okay, so, and does she believe it? And he said, she does. And he said, but I need to tell you that I do have feelings for you. And I'm an E6 and he's an E9 and I'm gay, but I'm closeted and nobody knows I'm gay, right? And so he has made it up in his mind that that he and I are in love. And we are not. We are not. And so I leave that deployment, I go back home. And Sue's cousin, who's watching my cat, is now apparently in love with me and has told his family that we are engaged. And so, but then while I'm gone, he sees a picture of me and Sue, and he has friends over, and those friends tell him, there's no way you're with her because those two are a couple. And so he puts two and two together, but now he's mad. And so I get home to a very angry man in my house, who then stalked me for months. I had to get the landlord to kick him out. He did all of these really horrific things to me. Just really super, super scary and abusive dude. And so, but he's living in my house and I have to try to get him out. The police won't do anything because he hasn't threatened my life. They won't remove him. And so who swoops in? Linda, right? My recovery buds. They, you know, I drive home one day and he's like behind me in his truck. I finally got him out of my house, but now he's following me. And so I called him and I'm just like, I gotta move. Like I need to be somewhere else. Like I was afraid he was gonna kill me. He's like sending letters to my command from Sue, my lesbian buddy, trying to get both of us in trouble. And it was just insane. And so they swoop in and they move me across the island one day. On a Sunday, like they just all show up. It's like these two guys, Kevin and Linda and these other people and, you know, U-Hauls and cars, and in a day I'm living somewhere else. And those are the people in this program that did that. And I didn't have people like that before, right? So I move across the island and never see him again, thank God. But I'm still at that command with H. And 2 years later, you know, I've deployed to Japan, and when I get back from Japan, I find out I make chief. And I'm having to work with this guy that I know has feelings for me, and I'm doing what we do, right? It's like, pretend like nothing's ever happened, you know, just walk on eggshells, he's still my mentor, all the things. And I make chief, and I transfer from Hawaii to Whidbey Island, Washington. And I'm going through chief's initiation up in Washington, okay? And making chief in the Navy is like, you change uniforms, everybody calls you chief, it's a big deal. And so in September of 1995, I put on the uniform of a chief petty officer. And I walk into, I have 3 years of recovery at this point, right? I've been away from my partner for 3 years. She and I are getting ready to be reunited in San Diego. I have just a few months before I go to San Diego. Everything's coming together, right? Make chief, stoked. I walk into work in my uniform the first day, and I walk up into my office. I walk in first. Everybody's like, good morning, chief. Good morning, chief. Good morning, chief. I go into my office. My sailors all hug me. It's a big deal, right? And I get called into my command master chief's office. He hands me his master chief anchors. So chiefs are E7, master chiefs are E9. And he says, I want you to have these for the day you make master chief. I'm so proud of you. And he's now my mentor again. Like, I'm thinking, like, maybe that shit is, like, behind me, right? And I'm, like, it's unreal to get somebody's anchors, first of all, but to get somebody's master chief anchors and the most senior guy in the squadron, pretty big deal. So I'm standing there, and he says, and there's something else I need to tell you. And he says, my life has been unbearable for the last couple of years, and I'm leaving my wife. And I want to be with you. I'm in love with you. And so I stand at the turning point, right? Because my life up until that point is not rigorous honesty, because I can't be honest, right? So I'm living the principles of the program, and I'm lying every day because I'm trying to save my ass and my career and live this life of, you know, where I have to hide who I am. And so I take a risk, and I tell him that I'm gay. And it was 1995, which was don't ask, don't tell. He's the most senior enlisted guy in my command. And I take a risk. My career could have been over in that moment. And I just watch him. Like, I watched he was so depressed, and I just watched the blood drain from his face. It was horrific. And that next Saturday, he took his life. And he took his life while his wife was on the phone with another wife telling her that he and I were having an affair. So the whole squadron now thinks that we were having an affair. And I am now the grieving girlfriend of my mentor, who I loved, who is now dead. And I have 3 years of recovery, right? And man, do you think I wanted to drink? But I didn't drink. I smoked a cigarette. It really sucked. No pun intended. It was horrible. But I didn't check out. Like, I couldn't check out. I just, but I was blamed for that suicide, and I blamed myself. I blamed myself. It was all my fault, that the reason that he died was because I told him that I'm gay. And so then I internalized this thing that when I tell people I'm gay, not only am I in danger, they're in danger, right? And it sealed that trauma within my body for a very long time. And so I transferred from that squadron as a chief 3 months later. And I remember like two situations. One, I was walking into work a couple weeks later because they gave me some time off because they thought I was his girlfriend and I was a grieving girlfriend. And I couldn't tell anybody. His mom is now wanting to be in contact with me because she wants to meet the woman that her son is in love with. I have a discussion with her brother or his brother because he wants to meet the woman. And I can't tell anybody that I'm gay. Like, I can't, I tell them that, you know, I wasn't in love with him, but I can't tell them what happened because my career is in jeopardy. And so I leave there 3 months. So the wife that he was on the phone with confronted me and screamed at me the day that I went back to work. And because I felt responsible for his death, I owned it. I was just like, yeah, I'm an asshole. I'm really sorry. And then I transferred and I made it down here. It was the end of 1995, and I made it to San Diego, back with Sue. And I spent another 11 years in my career being a chief. So back to like my dad, right? Best joy, right? Joy, pain. And then making chief, joy, pain, right? Like I had, that's the belief that I got. And then I made senior chief. And Sue was also up for senior chief, and she didn't make it. And that was 1998. I was at SEAL Team 5 at that point. And she didn't speak to me for 3 weeks. Joy, pain, right? Joy, pain. And so so I learned not to celebrate. Like, I learned not to celebrate making, like, achievements. I got out of the Navy in 2006. I spent 22 years in, did not have a retirement ceremony, right? No way in hell I'm celebrating. Got my bachelor's degree in psychology, got my master's degree in psychology, didn't celebrate, right? But stay sober, right? This is life. Like, life is, being human is not easy, but we stay sober, right? And nobody said I was gonna get a free ride, right? So in 2019, I'm living here, and I'm going to the Wednesday night meeting, and Kim's my sponsor, and I have all these wonderful ladies in my life, and Sue and I have now split. We split in 2009 because we just couldn't figure out how to be out and living our lives, and a lot of internalized homophobia at that point. And so I'm like living down here, and my dad dies. And I go back, so I have my dog, and we go back to Arizona, and I notice that my mom is falling apart. And so I knew in that moment I had to go back, and I had to support her. And so I left here in 2019, and I went back to Prescott, and I fell right back into oppressive Prescott, and then COVID hit, and my mom was suicidal, and my dog got diagnosed with congestive heart failure, and I'm tripping. Right? I'm just like, I'm isolated. I don't have all of, you know, my people around me. I lived in San Diego for 24 years. It was, sure, I knew the place, but I didn't really know anybody. And I'm writing this book about the steps to coming out from hiding, a self-help book. And I join a writing class. And I'm writing this self-help book, and my coach asks me, how do you know about this? And so I tell her the story about age. And I tell her these other stories about me and Sue. And I tell her about my life. And she says, well, that's what you have to write. And I said, there's no way in hell. I couldn't speak about H until I wrote a book without absolutely feeling like I was going to die. But I sat for 10 months. And I wrote a book. And I wrote a memoir called Hiding for My Life, Being Gay in the Navy. And I put everything that I had swallowed and hidden and kept from the world in that book. And what I learned by doing that was that by sharing my honest self, right, rigorous honesty, that I was free, right? What I thought was gonna happen, because the world is as it is, right? What I thought was gonna happen was that I would be targeted. And I thought that my house would be vandalized. And I thought that when people went into book events with me, that they would be in danger, because when you're around me, you're in danger, because I had internalized that, right? And that's not what's happened. It came out a year ago, and what's happened is gay veterans have read it, because it's the first book that talks about what it was like for us. And it's given voice for their experiences, and they've been able to share that book with their family members so their family members can see what they endured. And that's been worth it. And what's happened is I've been able to go into book events and speak with people who are serving now, who are afraid that they're gonna lose their careers. And I've been able to speak with trans service members who have 15 years and who have just been kicked out. And I get to sit and be a presence to people who were told they could come out of the closet and then got punished for it. That wasn't my experience. My experience was I knew the stakes all along. I knew that if I came out, that my career was over. And I took the risk with H because he needed to know my truth. I felt like it was the only way that he was going to figure out that I really wasn't in love with him. And I felt like, I thought he would move on. But that's just not what happened, right? Because that's life. And what's happened is that it's won 2 nationwide awards this year. And it's been recognized by, it's broken the belief that pain coincides with joy. It's broken the belief for me because what I expected was I'm going to put something out that I've put my blood, sweat, and tears into, and I'm going to be murdered. I'm going to be harmed. Something's going to happen. I was really spinning there for a while. You can ask him later. And it's not what's happened. I've been embraced. But that's what happens when we show up as our honest, authentic, true selves. We quit hiding behind our addictions. We quit hiding behind our personas. We quit hiding behind our uniforms. We quit hiding behind our perfectionism. All of the ways that we try to hide our beautiful, natural selves is a lie. Like, the best thing that we can do is show up and be our authentic selves. For some of us, it's not safe to do that. And in some places, it's not safe for me to do that. And I still do the best I can to be as honest as I can with every person who asks me today. I don't change pronouns. If somebody asks me if I'm in a relationship, you know, what was my last relationship like? Did I get a divorce from my husband? I say no, but my partner, she and I were together for 19 years. You know, I don't hide anymore because that's the way that I want to live my sober life. And I've learned through this program, I'm not perfect at it. The only thing that I've done perfectly for the last 33 years and 2 weeks is stay sober. So thanks for having me.
Thank you, Karen. How about another hand for Karen? Wow. All right. Let's see. Where's everybody going? I would like to thank